Welcome back to the Legal Digest podcast with your host, Natalie. Today I'm joined by Fumi. She was a private practice lawyer who now runs her own business as a mortgage broker for The Mortgage Mum. Hi, Fumi. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi there. Thank you for asking me to be on. Really pleased to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You're an experienced private practice lawyer. And I think when we initially spoke, you said that you moved in-house and you did a bit of contracting before you became a mortgage broker. So can you tell us a bit about your career journey into law and now as a business owner?
Yeah, sure. So I was thinking about this actually earlier this morning. And my first kind of entry into law was when I was at school. And I won a mock trial competition. So we had this little competition within the school. And me and this guy called Martin McCabe, I was actually wondering what happened to Martin this morning. Me and him, we entered this competition and we had to present a case. We got given a case and we had to kind of act for the prosecution and defence. It was a criminal case. And we actually were allowed to go to our local magistrate's court. It was in the evening, so they weren't in session. And present our case. And we won, which was really cool. And as part of the prize, I got to go and do work experience with a criminal barrister. And I remember doing this, and I was thinking, I can't actually believe I did this. So I went to Isleworth Crown Court, and it was this really quite big case at the time. Lots of defendants, and the barrister that I was working with was acting for one of the defendants. And I kind of sat through a week of that case. And that was kind of my first entry into the legal world, I guess.
Cool.
And then from that, I then became interested in law. And we didn't have law A level at my school, but I decided that it was something that I wanted to pursue when I went to university. So I actually ended up doing a law and business degree. I chose to do a split degree just because I thought if I did just law, it might be a bit boring. I'd like to sort of explore other things. And I also really liked business studies. I did that as an A-level. So I thought, why not do the two, which I did. And then I went from my university to law school. I went to Nottingham Law School. And then I was fortunate enough to get a training contract at a law firm in London. So after I'd finished law school, I ended up taking a year out and then started my training contract. I think it was 2003 now, so a long time ago, well, 20 years ago now. And then I stayed in that firm. I trained there and I qualified there and I stayed there. Then I got more and more interested in financial services. And there wasn't enough financial services work at that firm that I was at, so I decided to find a firm that did more of it. So I found that firm, I moved there, and I was there for 5 years. Did a couple of secondments to clients, so a couple of the big banks, worked there for periods of time. And then I left, as you said, I left private practice and started consulting. It just offered, I actually left private practice and went into one of the in-house roles I was in for a couple of years. And then I started consulting.
Okay.
It felt like it was a much more flexible way of working than I'd been used to. Law can be quite intense. And it just meant that I could have shorter term contracts and work in different types of companies. So for the next few years, I sort of did contracts of about a year to a year and a half in lots of different types of financial services firms until I then decided to leave the law altogether and start doing what I'm doing now.
Wow. I think the law is quite a... I mean, there's so many options available to you, right? So you can go in-house, private practice, and now there's contract... Well, there's always been contracting, but there's definitely other roles out there. So, yeah, I think it's, especially in private practice, it's quite restrictive, or it can be, especially if you're a woman. I don't want to stereotype, but I think for women it's harder when you get married and you have responsibilities or you have children. It's hard to do all of those hours, especially if you're in corporate.
I have a child, but I didn't have a child when I was working in private practice.
Yeah.
So if I now think back to how I would, you know, if I'd had a child, how I would have managed that work with one in private practice, I'm going to be honest, I think I would have struggled. Now, there are plenty of people that I know that do have families and do continue to work in private practice, but they also have, you know, a good support system around them that enables that to happen. Because when you're in private practice, as you can understand, you're client focused, you're client facing. And when a client asks you for something, generally, you know, your aim is to deliver on it. So that could mean working longer hours later in the evening. It could mean working weekends, which is tricky when you're trying to balance having a family, or even if you don't even have a family, just kind of having a life outside of the law. So it is quite a tricky balance working in private practice. I have a lot of respect for anyone, sort of men or women, who have families and manage to make it work, because it's hard.
Yeah, very demanding. And so what was your motivation for changing career path?
So because I've worked in financial services for so long, and the types of companies that I was working in, they were mainly what I would call retail finance. So that's kind of financial services and products focused at us as individuals. So things like overdraft products, current accounts, loans, credit cards, all of those types of products were the ones that I would be advising on from both a legal and compliance perspective. Right the way from, we've got this brilliant new idea for a new product, right the way through to, oh, customers have taken out this particular product, it was a loan, they can't repay, what do we do now? So that whole life cycle, I had a very good overview of that, and I was working with people at various points in that life cycle. And what I began to realise was, particularly with the credit type products, was that a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people, perhaps didn't really understand how those products worked. And that lack of understanding contributed to them getting in a bit of a pickle. So maybe not really appreciating that, you know, if you only make your minimum payments, it will take you quite a long time to pay off your balance. And you're also likely to pay quite a lot of interest as well. So I could see people getting themselves into situations that I thought, well, if they had more information at the outset, if they really understood what the products and services were and how they worked, would they still be in this situation? Now, I know that a lot of people, you know, life happens. So sometimes you can't control things and you might get into a bit of a situation with a credit product that you really can't help, and that's fine. But I always wondered, you know, is there more that can be done to give people the information and the knowledge so that they know they can make informed decisions effectively? So I was just really passionate about that. I've always been passionate about financial education, particularly financial education in our sort of formal education setting, which is sparse. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, what can I do? Is there anything I can do to kind of help improve, I guess, the literacy and the education and the knowledge of people? So that was kind of the main motivator. I'd seen it, sort of the bad side of the lack of understanding, or the negative consequences of the lack of understanding. And I wanted to see if there was something I could do to kind of help change that.
Yeah. And there's definitely, I guess, a lack of kind of education around financial well-being in schools and even at university. And I think when you go to university, it's the first time that you're set loose and you're able to manage your own finances, and you've got to think about rent and feeding yourself and keeping up with your course and everything. So I think it's great that you that's, you know, part of the reason why you decided to change career path. And so how did it feel going from working as a private practice lawyer to now doing something vastly different? Or perhaps it isn't vastly different, you know, maybe there's elements of it that are similar, but how did that feel?
Well, I guess I was quite fortunate. There was kind of a gradual change. I guess I went from private practice to in-house to sort of what I'm doing now. I think, if I'm honest with you, it feels really good, because mm-hmm. I really enjoy what I'm doing. I'm very fortunate to really enjoy what I do. I speak to lots of different people in very, very different situations. And it's a really good opportunity for me to broaden my knowledge and awareness of people. Because I think in private practice, you're generally dealing with a person who works for a large corporate, or I was in the work that I was doing.
Yeah.
Now I'm just dealing with what I would call quote unquote normal people, everyday people
right.
who just want to kind of, you know, get on with their lives. And maybe they need, well, for me at the moment in time, they need or they want a mortgage to help them with that. But, you know, there are so many different types of people that I probably would never be speaking to if it wasn't for the job that I'm doing. So I like it for that reason. And also I like it because I feel like I am making a difference. Now it sounds a bit cliche, but I really do. And I have, when you speak to somebody and they kind of really understand something, or they know that they can put in place a plan to get them to a place that they want to be, and you've been part of that and you've helped them, and you've given them that confidence. And confidence is a really big thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Helping people sort of develop and that confidence, you know, that's a great thing for them, but also, like, you know, I like to see it. I like to feel that I've made that difference to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. And confidence makes such a huge difference. I mean, someone who doesn't necessarily have all of the knowledge and skills or educational background may do much better just because they have the confidence to take them through whatever it is that they're trying to do. And I just remember, because your focus is on financial well-being now, when I was in law school, I was volunteering at the System Advice, and I remember doing what they would call gateway assessments, where you get people that would drop in and you would assess their problem and then signpost them or refer them to an advisor. And I remember seeing lots of people who had debt problems, and it was simple things that could have been prevented. So keeping up with their rental payments, or making sure they paid their credit card bill in time, but they didn't understand how that was going to affect their credit score. And then later down the line, when they try to apply for a mortgage. So, and then also, like, people have problems, as you said, like, things happen in life. They've got mental health issues, and that means that they forget, or they, like, it's almost like, I don't know, if I can say procrastination, but it's like they put things off because they've got other issues. So there's, I think it leads to other things that have to be kind of dealt with as a society, but there isn't really anyone else kind of out there saying to people, well, make sure you pay your credit card bill on time, because that's going to affect your credit score if you try to apply for a mortgage or a loan of some sort. So yeah, it's definitely it's definitely something that needs to be kind of expanded on and probably included in school education as well.
I was going to say, like, just picking up on a couple of things you said there. There are so many links between mental health and what I would call financial health and well-being. You know, if you're not in a great place mentally, that can have a huge impact on how you deal with or how you manage your money. And then you get into this kind of cycle, because then if you're not managing your money well, and then you get into difficulty managing your money, that can then exacerbate any sort of mental health issues that you might have. So there are strong links between those two that I think are really important that we as a society need to be very conscious of and need to address. I think the bigger topic around well-being, and particularly financial well-being, it's something that's being spoken about a lot more at the moment, which I think is really, really positive. I think, you know, there's the practical element. There's the kind of, how does a credit card work, and what do you need to do? What shouldn't you do if you want to, you know, be building your credit score? But then there's also, I guess, the sort of emotional element around how we think and we feel about money. Whether we're even conscious of the fact that we all have a relationship with money, it might be a positive one, it might be a negative one, and how that then impacts on the decisions that we make. So it's kind of really important to explore all of those things. I think, going back to the point around schools, I think it's really, really important to start to have the conversation when people are in school. I think then you can do almost like a one-to-many approach, because you can speak to a lot of people at the same time. And there's research that shows that your sort of money habits and behaviours start to form around the age seven, which is really, really young.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, when you think about it, it makes sense, because children copy or, you know, absorb what happens around them. So if they're living in a situation whereby, you know, money management is dealt with in a particular way, it's not a great leap of imagination to believe that, you know, they're then potentially going to treat money in the same way, because they've taken in all those influences. So I think it's really important to sort of start that conversation early. Anyway, within, you know, be realistic about what you're going to say. I'm not saying let's sit all the seven-year-olds down with a credit card set of terms, conditions, and talk them through it, because that's very boring. And, you know, but I think talking about concepts such as, you know, what borrowing is and what it means. So yes, you can borrow, but then you might then need to give back more than you borrowed. Those, you know, I think we can find ways to do it. And there is a lot of work that's going on to try and sort of push the agenda within schools and other educational settings. But it's just that it's not widespread yet. So not every school does it or has that to the same extent. So I think there's a way to go in relation to that. But yeah, I think people are working on it. I think I saw something recently, Stephen Bartlett, the entrepreneur, he came out and he said he wanted to try and create a money school for the residents of Grenfell, because he'd been to Grenfell recently.
Right.
And one of the things that I think had been asked for was, you know, help around managing money, entrepreneurship, and all of those types of things. So something that he was talking about as well. Martin Lewis, a few years ago, produced a sort of a personal finance textbook that he sent to every school in the country. So there are people that are sort of talking about this, which is great. It's just kind of whether it's gaining enough traction quickly enough that I have, that yeah, is the question. And then also about comment about university, it's such a good point. I think we have people in a formal education system, and then they either leave and start working, or they go off to university, and it's their kind of first taste of adulthood. Yeah. And that's the point when things are being, effectively, they are getting, you know, marketed to. Mm-hmm. It would be their first taste of kind of credit. Yeah. And there's so many people that say, you know, I didn't really understand it. It kind of felt a bit like it was free money.
Mm.
And then they kind of spent. And, you know, I speak to people that, you know, decades down the line, that's kind of where they would identify. They kind of started getting into difficulty with money, but they didn't realize it at the time because it felt like free money. And they were spending, and it was fun, and they're encouraged to have it. And their balances, their credit limits were maybe being increased, and they just didn't really comprehend what that meant. So there's kind of lots of trigger points, I think, in our lives where it would be really good to kind of have some conversations and get some information about sort of what we might be experiencing, what we might be seeing at that point in time, and what different products and services that are being marketed to us, because, you know, we are constantly being marketed to, let's be honest about this, how we can use those, how they work, and what we can do. And actually, probably most importantly, what we can do if we do get into trouble with them, because I think a lot of people maybe just don't know what to do and they bury their heads in the sand, which, you know, never going to make your situation better. But I totally understand why things might feel quite overwhelming. And if you don't know where to go for help or support, then you may just do nothing, which inevitably makes it worse.
Yeah. So I wanted to now move on to some of the listener questions that were sent through. So before we had this conversation, I asked people on Instagram if they had questions about financial well-being. So the first one is Moneybox estimate that there are 1.8 million households in the UK that will be ending their fixed rate period this year. Do you have any tips for listeners who might be experiencing difficulties or who are worried about it affecting them?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I really do feel for people, particularly sort of back end of last year and this year, because the mortgage market has been quite turbulent over the past few months in particular. And what we've sort of experienced and seen has been sort of over sort of the past year or so, a gradual increase in the interest rates. Now, I guess to put it in context, for the past sort of decade or so, we did have incredibly low interest rates, you know, sort of coming off the back of the financial crisis. And in the context of hundreds of years of interest rates, that decade-long period, which felt like probably felt like the norm for a lot of people because it was so long. But in context, that was quite unusual. So I think a lot of people, as I completely understand, sort of used that, you know, low interest rate, brilliant, I can get a mortgage. And then also kind of compounded by during COVID, we had those sort of stamp duty breaks, which meant that people were able to save money on stamp duty because a lot of people were moving and buying property. A lot of people then took out products that maybe lasted for about 2 or 3 years, and those products are now sort of coming to an end and people are having to remortgage.
Yeah.
And this is when it's now looking a bit tricky, because the landscape we're in now, the interest rates we're looking at now, are quite different to the ones that you probably had with your current mortgage. So people coming off fixed rate mortgages now were probably on like a 1% or a 2%. And what we're looking at now is maybe 4%, 5%. So it does make a difference. So I totally understand why people are worried about this. What I would say, if you're one of those people, is a few things. The first thing I would say is don't panic, which I know sounds like an easy thing to say, but there are options that you may have. So I think it's really important to A, not panic, but B, speak to a professional, speak to an expert who can talk you through your options. Second thing I would say is find out when your fixed rate is actually ending. A lot of people think, it's a 2-year product or it's a 3-year product. So it's 2 years from maybe the date that I move. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it might end a little bit sooner. So what you want to be doing is finding out exactly when your product is ending, counting sort of back 6 months, and putting that date in your diary, because that's the date, that's the latest date at which you should be speaking to an advisor. And the reason why I say this is because you can actually reserve a product up to 6 months in advance. So let's say, for example, your product's coming to an end in October. You could maybe by April, you're starting to speak to a mortgage advisor, and they'll be able to look at your situation, talk to you about, you know, what your life is like, what it's looking like over the next few years, and then help you come up with a plan for a product for you to have. And if you can reserve that product, you know, in the April time, you then have that comfort and security that you know exactly what you're going to be paying come October when your current rate ends. And that gives a lot of people some comfort and security. Now, for some products, you actually can change during that time. So you could reserve a rate, in the example, in April. And then if a better rate comes along, you may then be able to change to that rate. Some lenders will let you do that. It's free of charge. Some lenders will let you do that, but you may have to pay a fee. So that's why I really would urge everyone to speak to an advisor, because, you know, we're working in this day in, day out. We know what lenders are doing what. We know what the best options will be for you in your particular situation. So as tempting as it might be just to go on Google, or just to kind of go on like affordability calculators, I would always say, look, do those things, that's fine, but also come and speak to an expert, because they will be looking at your very individual situation. In terms of people who are worrying about kind of the increase in costs, you know, there is likely to be an increase in cost, because you're paying, you know, a lower interest rate now, and you'll be paying a higher interest rate when your mortgage comes around. But there are things that we could do to look and see how can you manage that increase in the monthly payments. So, for example, one thing that could be an option is to extend the term of your mortgage. So let's say at the moment you've got a 20-year mortgage. You could consider whether, or the impact of extending that out to 25 years. Now, the benefit would be that your monthly payments would come down. You know, well, 20 years versus 25 years, your monthly payments will be lower than the 25-year one. Now, obviously, that means that you're then paying interest for a longer period of time. So you would pay more interest overall, but that may be something that you're willing to do if it means that your monthly payments are more manageable. And what's really, really key is that your monthly payments are manageable and you can afford to make them, you know. So those are kind of the tips. Speak to an advisor, know when your actual mortgage is coming to an end. And consider all the different options, which you'll do when you're speaking to that advisor.
Yeah.
But yeah, don't panic, get advice.
Yeah. It's always dangerous to Google things anyway. I mean, initially to get an idea, but then I always feel like it's make things seem worse than it actually is when you look on Google, because you'll see people say, you know, kind of like the worst thing possible, or rather than giving you options, and it doesn't take into account your individual scenario. So the next question, so the next question is it the right time for first-time buyers to invest in property?
I get asked this question quite a lot. Again, I would say it depends. All of these questions, I guess, are probably unhelpful, but they're all kind of person specific in your individual situation. I think at the moment, what I'm seeing quite a lot of is what I would call doom and gloom when it comes to property in the housing market. And I see people talk about, or people use the word, there's going to be a property crash or a housing market crash, which I think, you know, crash sounds incredibly dramatic. I think what we're likely to see, or what we're seeing at the moment, is perhaps maybe a correction or a reduction in the house price growth, which I think is something that probably needed to happen anyway, because house prices were growing at such a level that it was quite, you know, it wasn't sustainable, as we're now sort of seeing. I think also it depends on different areas will be different. So there may be some areas where property prices maybe are decreasing. So you might think, well, I don't really want to buy there. Or you could think, well, actually, I'm going to get myself a bargain. There's ways in which you can look at it. But I think look at what you want to do. Look at how long you want to stay in a property. I think the days of maybe moving in, staying there for a year, painting it in Farrow and Ball colours, and then making a huge profit when you sell, I feel like those days for the most part are probably behind us. I think property should be seen as, unless it's a business maybe, as a longer term investment. You know, if you're buying to live in it, it's going to be your home.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure that it's somewhere that you really love, or that you can grow to love. And I would always say buy for the longer term. You know, be thinking sort of 3, 4, 5 years in advance rather than 1 or 2. And if you can find a property that you like, if you can afford it, and again, affordability is the key here.
Mm-hmm.
Find somewhere you like, you can afford it, you see yourself being there sort of 3, 4, 5 years plus, then I think it's definitely an option to consider. I don't think people should be put off buying. I don't think we should necessarily believe all the doom and gloom, because historically, as we've seen, as the data shows us, generally prices will increase.
Yeah.
So if you're willing to hold something for the longer term, then the likelihood is you will see an increase in the value of that property. But I can understand why people are maybe a bit reluctant or hesitant, because the news at the moment isn't really terribly positive. So again, speak to an advisor, see what amount you can borrow.
Mm-hmm.
But then also think to yourself, you know, what can I really afford? Because if you can borrow a particular amount, but that means that your monthly payments are going to be so high that you never leave the house again, you never go on holiday, you never see your friends, you know, is that really the life that you want either? So I would always say kind of weigh it up and then ultimately make a decision that's right for you.
Yeah. And I think it must also be quite frustrating for people who were stuck in that kind of renting houses throughout their 20s, finally managed to save up some money, and now we're in a situation they think, oh God, what do I do? You know, I can buy a house, but I don't know if it's the right time. So yeah, I think everything that you said is, you know, really useful guidance and tips for people in those kind of situations. And then lastly, there was one last question, which is, are there any resources that you would recommend people look at just to kind of for information on financial well-being, how they can kind of you know, where can they get information on how to be better at managing their finances?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of resources, and I wonder if sometimes maybe that is the problem, there's too many. I think, you know, it depends on what you like doing. So, for example, if you're somebody who likes reading, there are books that you can buy, personal finance books that you can buy. If you're somebody that likes, I love listening to podcasts. So there are loads of different sort of finance podcasts I listen to. So off the top of my head, I can think of Claire Barrett's The Money Clinic, which I find really good. Money Box, I really like the Which Money podcast. There's a podcast called Money Unfiltered, which is sort of conversations about topics that kind of touch on money as well, but really, really interesting. Lots of different podcasts that you could listen to if you're somebody who likes that. Then there are websites that you can go to. So, for example, there's the Money Helper website, which is a government sort of run website that gives people information about financial products and services. Follow me on my Instagram page, big plug there. But yeah, there are, I mean, actually, I think social media, it is a great place for information. I guess what I would always say though is make sure the person that you're following is kind of qualified to talk about what they're talking about. So whilst I would encourage people to kind of, you know, be open and listen to people, kind of always just, you know, are they you know, what experience do they have? Have they been through something themselves? Anybody that's interested in sort of credit and debt, there's a great Instagram page run by a lady called Sarah Williams called Debt Camel. She puts great information out there for people that are interested in that. Yeah, I think there are a lot of resources. I think what we could do with though is almost like, and I guess Money Helper kind of is that to a certain extent, but like a verified, almost like a verified set of resources that people can go to and feel confident about going to. But I think, yeah, you're right, it's half the problem, isn't it? If you kind of think you want to learn about something, but you don't really know where to go. I think we need, we as an industry, as a finance industry, need to be much better at that, I think.
Yeah. And then I think you mentioned that you were putting together a checklist. Is that right?
Yeah, so because just touching on the question that came up about sort of how can you prepare if you are one of the people who's going to need to remortgage this year. So I'm putting it in, it will be done by the time this episode comes out, but I'm going to put a little checklist on my Instagram page. So you'll be able to go to the page and click on and just find it. And I'll just set out the key points or the key suggestions I have for people who are thinking of remortgaging or need to remortgage and kind of want to know sort of what should I be doing, what order should I be doing it in, when should I be doing it. I would always really emphasize that if you're somebody, for example, if you're self-employed or if you were employed when you first took out your mortgage and you're now self-employed, there are potentially some additional things you might need to show. So if that's you, then maybe, you know, make sure you leave enough time. Don't leave this to the last minute, if at all possible. Because the longer time you have to prepare, the better you'll feel. You won't be making decisions in a rush. People generally don't make their best decisions when they're under time pressure.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you and have you on. That brings us to the end of this episode. We will leave FundMe's details in the episode's description. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a rating and a review.